Hi again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 17th of June. And our guest this hour is the author of Big Man on Campus, A University President Speaks Out on Higher Education. Stephen Joel Trachtenberg is Professor Emeritus and University Professor of Public Service at the George Washington University, served as the 15th president of the university for almost 20 years. He was also president at the University of Hartford for a number of years, and at Boston University as Dean of Arts and Sciences. He was a special assistant to the U.S. Education Commissioner, also author of Thinking Out Loud, The Wit and Wisdom of Stephen Joel Trachtenberg, Reflections on Higher Education, and he has written other books and is co-editor of The Art of Hiring in America's Colleges and Universities. His articles have appeared in many newspapers and chronicles. He is a native of Brooklyn. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050, or email addresses are always talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Trachtenberg, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. Yeah. Delighted to be here.
Tell me about the description. You were on this airplane and you're describing your job to the person sitting next to you, and the job just sounded so enormous.
Well, I didn't say I was a university president.
No.
What I said is that I was responsible for this community, which sat on 50 acres and which was composed of thousands of people. And in which we did a variety of things. We had athletics, and we had bookstores, and we had theaters, and we had dining facilities and residence facilities, and we gave some lectures. And he said to me, "Oh, you must be a mayor." And I said, "No, no." And then I, of course, laughed, and I told him I was a university administrator and a president. And he said, "I never thought of a university that way, but now that you break it out, I understand."
Right. There's a lot that goes on at a university, sir, isn't there?
It's a complex community, many stakeholders, many internal communities, some of them pulling in the same direction and some of them pulling in different directions.
Right. I was interested that you took this test. I can't remember how old you were, that showed where your proclivities were, where your interests were. And I think the answer was you ought to manage something like a YMCA.
Yes.
That's great.
I was a senior in college at Columbia in New York. And I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, so I went and took an exam, and I was astonished, thinking back on it years later, at how accurate it was, because what you do as a university president ultimately is very similar to what they proposed, namely that I should run the YMCA, or you could imagine a hospital administrator or a city manager. There are many callings which fall under that umbrella.
Right. But there must have been something early on, and you write about your early years in public schools, that attracted you to the world of ideas.
Well, I loved argumentation. I loved the environment of a university, and I thought, this is terrific. How can you make a living out of it?
Mm.
And initially, I couldn't quite figure it out. Frankly, I didn't think I was clever enough to be a professor. And so I decided to go to law school instead. And after graduating from law school, I practiced for a couple of years. And then I met a congressman, and he was on the U.S. House Education and Labor Committee. He invited me to come work for him. I decided to do that, and I got to be familiar with education legislation.
Hmm.
And that led me into university work.
Mm-hmm. I know that so much of your time, and I wonder if this was really a burden of the job, as it must be a burden for a lot of politicians, too, is being in the business of getting money.
Well, money, of course, is the mother's milk of,
right.
of most enterprise. Universities, no exception. I actually like people a lot, and I don't mind spending time with them and trying to encourage them to share a vision. And if you love universities and enjoy talking about them in the company of others, fundraising turns out to be a lot more pleasurable than is generally thought. I grant you, it can get wearisome after a while.
Mm-hmm.
And facing the end of a budget cycle and trying to figure out can you raise that extra $1 million so you come out at the end of the year in the black, can be very daunting. But if the mission is one you are emotionally and psychologically committed to, helping students, helping professors, raising the funds seems to be the Lord's work.
You write in the book that 80%, I didn't know this, and it seems like a huge number to me, 80% of endowments are held by 16% of universities.
Yes. Well, you know, you have to think of Harvard first, of course.
Right.
And they've got, I don't know, $37 billion. So their endowment is larger than the gross national product of Romania. and then there's Yale. I mean, so what you have is a handful of institutions that are enormously wealthy. And then it trickles down to, remember, there are 4,000 universities and colleges, post-secondary institutions in the country. It trickles down to institutions that, frankly, have almost nothing and whose budgets are very much like those of a theater. They sell tickets at the door. You go in and hear the see the movie, and then that's how they run the enterprise. In universities, they sell credit hours in the form of tuition, and that's how they pay for the faculty and the books and the material you need to run a university. And that is more true of more universities than the image of universities sort of as gut bucks.
Right, yeah. Why is it then that so few universities have such huge endowments?
Well, most of them didn't get going raising money until fairly recently.
I see.
The state institutions, of course, came to the game late. For a long time, the lion's share of their operating budget was funded by the taxpayers. But you know what's been going on in Wisconsin,
sure.
And it turns out it's true all over the country. Less and less of the state university budget is paid by the taxpayers, and the university itself is obliged to meet more and more of its bills through fundraising, through endowment, through overhead on research grants, and, of course, through tuition. That is even more true in the independent, the private universities, where they get nothing or very little from the state, and so they are even scrappier.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about poor students. You talk in the book about there being underrepresented at larger universities, private schools in this country, because they don't have enough information about how to navigate the system. Is that fair to say?
That's partly the problem. Well, first of all, of course, it's always harder to get any kind of service, whether it's medicine or
sure.
or education or housing, if you're poor rather than rich. It's good to be rich, and that's one of the reasons. There are benefits that have come to it. But part of the question also is who is poor, and frequently they are new Americans, and even if they are legacy Americans, people who've been here for several generations. Not having money generally means you're not terribly well-educated, and if you're not terribly well-educated, you don't know the moves, and you don't know how to apply to colleges and how to go after financial aid. There's a great deal more aid. There's a great deal more access than people generally know, and that's a great tragedy because we leave frequently leave opportunity on a table that youngsters who were aware of it could take advantage of.
So what did you do about that as president?
Well, I put more money, of course, into our financial aid scheme so that by the time I left George Washington University, we were investing $120 million a year in financial aid for undergraduates.
Really?
But in addition to that, you have to reach out. And we used to reach out to inner-city schools, and we reached out to community colleges through articulation agreements so that kids could transfer after their sophomore year in a community college to junior standing at George Washington and finish up their bachelor's degrees in only 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was more economic, and we would find them even if they didn't find us.
Hmm. And you write about community colleges. They may be underrated. It may be a perfect way for some students to go.
I'm a great fan of community colleges. I think they are to higher education what jazz is to music, an authentically American institution, terribly well-suited to serve our people and our country. They serve both vocational and academic interests. They make it possible for somebody who hasn't got the interest or the enthusiasm to go through 4 years to have 2 years of post-secondary education that makes it possible for them to contribute to the economy and get good jobs and also live full lives. And they are accessible. They are inexpensive. The tuition at community colleges in some places is as low as $400 a year.
Hmm.
And even when it's higher, it doesn't top more than $1,200. And there are financial aids for that. Moreover, they are accessible because there is a community college practically within commuting distance of every American.
Hmm.
And so you can get to them physically, and they have programs that serve a wide range of interests. Vocational, intellectual. They have terminal programs. They have programs that allow you to go to other institutions. They are a splendid institution. Their one shortcoming, and I think it's important to say this, is that their persistence rate needs to be attended to. That is to say, students enroll and don't always finish. And that's because, again, financial problems come up. These are indifferent students and they're not quite sure why they're there. The community colleges need to be graduating more of the people who come to them, but they are a great potential service to our country.
Yes. Let's talk a little bit about what has happened to foreign students coming to places in this country. You talk about a bit of a decline exacerbating after 9/11 when we threw up walls to screen international students because of security concerns.
Exactly.
Is that still going on?
Well, it is. I mean, we are being more careful about who we admit to the country in every possible way. All you have to do is get on an airplane and see everybody taking their shoes off and
right.
taking their belts off. So you know that we are a country that is focused on this concern, and rightly so. There are people who want to hurt us, both domestic and international. That said, it's foolish to try and build a wall around the country and keep businessmen out, and keep students out, and keep tourists out. Down that road lies madness. When the dust settled after 9/11, I and many other university presidents went to see the then Secretary of State and the Secretary of Commerce and various congressmen and senators and said, look, obviously we have to have our heads screwed on right. We have to look after security, but we ought not become an isolationist country.
No.
And so over time, the number of students from abroad has started to be restored, although we lost students, and I think to some extent irretrievably, because they discovered there's a new world out there called Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa, other English-speaking countries with very developed university programs who are happy to have them.
Yeah.
But we are still the greatest university system in the world to the extent that we are a system. And if you look at what goes on across the 50 states, it cannot be replicated anyplace else on the planet.
Phone calls we go to for the author of Big Man on Campus, A University President Speaks Out on Higher Education. Professor Stephen Joel Trachtenberg is our guest, Professor Emeritus and University Professor of Public Service at the George Washington University. He served as president for almost 20 years. He was also president of the University of Hartford, also at Boston University as Dean of the Dean of Arts and Sciences, and has written a number of books as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, Milwaukee 414-227-2050, email address talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls now for Professor Trachtenberg, starting with Jeff from Dubuque. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning, Dr. Trachtenberg.
Good morning, sir.
Hey, I spent 20 years in higher education working in the area of career planning and placement, and I was the one who administered some of those interest tests that you may have taken at Columbia. but the issue I'd appreciate your comments on is the lack of teaching of creative thinking, more specifically, as you scan higher education. There is no major in creative thinking, no interdisciplinary focus on creative thinking, and no way of harvesting the ideas of college-educated students across disciplines in order to benefit our economy, create new products, solve solutions. I'm a big believer in the power of higher education to be a force in helping, but yet I see a lot of focus on critical thinking, but not as much on creative thinking. And I'd appreciate your thoughts.
Good question. Thanks.
Yes, I'm not sure how you would do that except to educate students thoroughly, perhaps in the liberal arts and with a good component of the sciences, and make them feel free, make them feel that if they express themselves, they're going to be encouraged and rewarded, and that if they make mistakes, they're not going to be critically judged or punished. And we need to take some of the pressure off to get grades, to get jobs as a result of the grades, to get into law schools and medical schools. We need to make life on university campuses a little more fail-safe. We need students to be able to try and be student reporters and actors and scientists and to float ideas, understanding that they're going to get it wrong sometimes, and so what? I think there's too much conformity, too much concern that their teachers or their classmates won't think well of them, and that inhibits, I think, students from being as creative as they might otherwise be.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit, and you write about this, this pull between research and teaching, and how a university deals with that. What did you do with that issue?
Well, it's a never resolved issue. I've been getting back into the classroom and teaching again this year after all those years in administration, and so I went back and studied the literature of higher education, which of course I had neglected while I was practicing, and what I discover is that these issues, the pull between teaching and research, for example, have been debated in universities for 30, 40, 50 years. You go back, you read the old books, and there are these issues still on the agenda today. And it's an impossible thing to solve easily. On the one hand, it is the role of universities to educate people, to transfer knowledge from one generation to another. On the other hand, you have to create knowledge in order to be able to transfer it. You have to constantly be on the cutting edge. And so you want your faculty engaged with new ideas themselves so that they are fresh. They're not using 20-year-old notes when they get up in front of the podium. And universities are unresolved. You take a university like the University of Wisconsin, which at Madison has practically $1 billion research budget. And much of that is procured through outside funding from federal agencies and foundations and elsewhere. Well, universities want to encourage that.
Sure.
And the president and the deans are going to say to professors, good boy, good girl. They're going to pat them on the head when they get grants. Well, to do that, those professors are going to be taking time that they might otherwise be spending with Jane and John in the classroom, mm-hmm. or counseling them.
Mm-hmm.
And so finding the balance between being a nurturing teacher and being a learned scholar and researcher is a challenge for all our institutions of higher education.
Mm-hmm. What's the pool of talent out there for truly creative, inspirational, wonderful teachers?
Well, there's never enough of that. I mean, that's a very distinguished group. But there certainly are a sufficient number of people who are capable of being very good teachers. And I'm not sure everybody has to be Einstein in everything they do and touch. Very good will do most of the time. The problem, again, is that universities have to compete for talent with other aspects of our society. The military world needs scholars and scientists. Business and commerce needs scholars and scientists, and they pay better. And Wisconsin, for example, has had a challenge in the last few years where other universities have been stealing people from the state, and other industries and professions have been pulling people away from the University of Wisconsin. And I couldn't help but notice that when Kathleen Dunn was named as the new chancellor, one of her first priorities was to try and address the compensation of professors. And that, of course, has to be balanced with appropriate scholarship aid for the very best students. It's like everything else, the need for the golden mean.
Right. Jeff, thanks very much for the call. Mike from Appleton. Hello, Mike.
Yes, good morning. Professor, how are you?
Well, thank you.
I may be getting started early on this. My son is going into high school next year. He's an exceptional student. He's exceptionally bright to the point that, you know, he teaches himself Latin. He's taught himself music.
Goodness.
But I don't have due to circumstances of life, I do not have a good financial situation. But this kid's a treasure. So how do I steer him? How do I direct him?
Well, I wouldn't worry about that, to tell you the truth. I mean, it's always nice to have money, but it is not necessary to have bags of gold in the bedroom in order for your youngster to be able to get a good education. You can get a terrific education in the institutions within Wisconsin, and then you've got 49 other states to look at, and indeed even Canada. I mean, so don't restrict yourself, and have your son. Reach out. Harvard University, Yale University, Columbia University, George Washington University have scholarship plans that are designed to see to it that socioeconomic handicaps are not limitations to enrollment. Obviously, they're going to be admitting many students who come from wealthy backgrounds, but they robustly encourage students from every economic status to enroll at the institution. What they're looking for, frankly, is talent. And by the way, if your son can play basketball, that doesn't hurt either.
Exactly. Thanks very much for the call. Reed from Clintonville. Hi.
Good morning. Say, just to respond to a previous caller, a young man asked or said there is nothing around, there are no places that teach anything about creative problem solving. However, my wife's PhD is creative problem solving.
Mm.
She teaches in the School of Ed at UW-Stevens Point. I know that Buffalo State in New York has a program related to creative problem solving. My wife is the creator of an originator of Destination Imagination, a creative problem solving program, competition program for public schools. And so there's a source for him.
Yeah, and that's terrific. I think that's very helpful. You want to build creative problem solving on a basis of knowledge in conventional disciplines. In other words, you don't want to try and be a creative problem solver before you've mastered verbal skills, quantitative skills, and before you're on top of either history or economics or one of the classic fields of knowledge, because you don't want to go to form rather than form informed by substance.
Mm-hmm. And thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Kathy next from Milwaukee. Hello, Kathy.
Hello. I have kind of a specific question, but I'm really having trouble having it answered. So I was hoping that the professor could answer it for me. I work with low-income students, and often the parents are unwilling to provide financial information for the application for student aid. Is there any way to circumvent that?
Well, you know, it's America. You know, you can't put a gun to people's heads. I think you have to give them some sense of the fact that they're depriving their children of mm-hmm. an opportunity. I think mm-hmm. part of it is fear. Some of it is embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is they're afraid of authority and they're worried that if they share this information, somehow it will injure them.
Mm-hmm.
Lord, it takes hard work by counselors like you and others to make these moms and dads understand that the world is searching for their talented youngsters and will provide financial aid. But obviously, they need to be able to demonstrate that there's an appropriate reason to provide it.
Why do you think they're unwilling to provide the information, Kathy? Is it embarrassment?
Partially also, maybe they have a tax liability, maybe they're, maybe they're involved in some sort of illegal, you know, activity. I mean, that's just reality, you know, and, so I think those reasons might be part of it, to be
mm-hmm.
honest with you.
Yeah, that's a difficult question. I mean, you don't want to coerce people, but you do want to inspire them to be there for their children.
Right. Thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Bob from Darlington next. Hello, Bob.
Oh, hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking
sure.
my call, and welcome to the professor.
Thank you.
I worked for the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus in the Center for, yeah, would you, Audrey? My wife's going to turn the radio off.
Huh? Okay.
Yeah, probably works better. For 35 years, and my wife almost the same in chemistry, and I worked for Center for Health Sciences.
Right.
And I think that I worked in the lab setting with the in pharmacology lab with the med students, pharmacy students, and nursing students.
Right.
And my wife worked in placement service in chemistry. But why are they so well motivated compared to other disciplines? And I can say that because I had, you know, the length of time that we both worked there, we saw students from all kinds of other departments. Not that they're not motivated; it's just that the medical science people seem to be really gung ho and do the work. And
well, I think you don't get there until unless you're motivated. It's a very high threshold, and so by the time somebody gets into that sort of a situation, their interest has been finely honed. I mean, people who go on to medical school generally have their eye on it. Oh, sometimes from elementary school and yeah. Really secondary school.
My son, he's a dermatologist up in Rhinelander.
Right.
He's been in practice for almost 30 years now, and he said he wanted to be a doctor since age 9.
Oh, my.
Yeah, there you
and
go.
And he's a specialist. He's a kind of a skin cancer specialist.
Right. Right. Well, that's terrific. I think that's right, although, you know, it's interesting. So often kids say they want to be things they don't even know what they are. You know, you run into children who say they want to be lawyers, and it's largely because of what they see on television, not because they themselves have ever had any contact with lawyers. And there's an awful lot of lawyers out there in America who aren't happy. I'm sure that's true in all professions, that it turns out you get buyer's regret. You know, you end up becoming something only to discover you thought it'd be nicer to be doing something else on second reflection.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you say something in the book about changing the way we teach med students? You said something, I think, about senior year could be the beginning of med school.
Well, I think we waste a great deal of money and a great deal of time with the senior year in high school. Once a kid gets into college, they practically, you know, turn off until they go off to campus.
Right.
And that's true to some extent in our colleges as well. So I do believe that that we can educate doctors proficiently in 7 years. It doesn't have to take a 4-year bachelor's degree and a 4-year medical degree. We can do it in a combined, integrated 7-year program. And there are universities in this country that do it in a 6-year program. And the data shows over longitudinal studies over time that the doctors who graduate from these compressed programs come out every bit as able as doctors who take 8 years.
Hmm.
Now, I don't want to rush anybody through. I want people to have as much pleasure in education as possible. But in a time where it's $50,000, $60,000 a year to educate somebody, there may be some, there may be many, who would say, I'd rather do a 7-year program than an 8-year program and save that year and save that expense and be in the job market a year earlier. And as we look out at the aging baby boomers, we're going to need more doctors and more people of all different aspects of healthcare. And so finding ways to be more efficient in the educating of these professionals, I think, is worth our attention.
Right. We've had a couple people who have sent emails, and I know you took that career test, quite some time ago. Do you recommend that young people take a test like that to see where their skills are and where they may be happy in their profession? And if so, where should they go?
It can't hurt. I mean, I wouldn't be hypnotized by any of these things. I think, you know, you could get something that said you should do one thing, and you say, well, I don't want to do that. Well, then you shouldn't. But I think when many of us are young, we're not certain what we're best suited for, and having the advantage of such examinations, which have been developed by psychologists over time, can be very informative. And so, yes, I would encourage people to take these exams.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob, so much for the call. Nat is next from Madison. Hi, Nat.
Hi, how are you?
Fine,
greetings, Professor. I have two questions that are somewhat related to one another. The first one, I'm a doctoral candidate here at UW-Madison,
right.
And I'm in the humanities. And the first has to do is, what do you think from your background in administration, both at research universities and at private universities, what the future of the long-term future, the short-term and long-term future is of the humanities in general, because the humanities at a number of universities, particularly in philosophy, the case at UW, at University of Florida comes to mind, and also at the University of Southern California with the case of the German department,
yes,
seems to be under assault. And related to that also has to do with what is the nature of an education, or in terms of more and more, okay, I've been teaching now for a while, I see that students generally seem to believe that they, even wealthy students when they come to the university, or students that, you know, have all the advantages of a good education and a good family life and stuff, they seem to believe that the university is simply a place of a credential, of getting a credential.
Yes.
And what I try to emphasize to my students, and they seem to look at me with, like, they look at me as if I'm on crack, when I say to them is that, you know, going to college is not really about getting a job. It's about learning how to ask the right questions and giving you the information needed to lead a richer life.
Hmm.
Well, you're right, of course, and but we've been sending mixed signals for a long time. I remember the slogan, stay in school, you'll earn more. What we've done is correlated education with money, and the notion somehow that if you get a degree, you're going to have a rich life, and that, using dollar signs as the measuring yard, rather than a rich life using life satisfaction as the yardstick. What we have is a problem being in the 21st century in America, in which we are a practical country, and we like to think that if we're going to spend money on education, it's going to have a material outcome. And that said, inevitably, the humanities are imperative, because we not only want to be able to do things, we want to be able to do the right things, and we want to be able to think about our society and our culture and our personal lives, and it's important, therefore, that we be knowledgeable about religion, about literature, about the arts, as well as being able to have the skills of farmers and mechanics, which is at the heart of the founding of the great public research universities. We're facing problems of escalating costs and rising tuition, and in order to justify the stipends that parents and taxpayers make in universities, we need to be able to show that what we're doing is good for society and that we are using the money as efficiently as possible. And so I think in the next decade, there's going to be more and more pressure for transparency. You have a new chancellor coming in at the University of Wisconsin. She's going to be going to the governor. She's going to be going to the legislature, and she's going to say the University of Wisconsin is one of the great research universities on the planet. We need to keep it that way. And in order to do that, you have to invest more. And they need to be able to say to her, okay, we're going to do that. Can you show us where the benefit is and that you are using all these dollars wisely? I'll give you an example of something I talk about in my book, and which has been a source of great frustration to me. I get a calendar every December from the local garage, and it has, it turns out, 52 weeks in it. 12 months, 52 weeks. And then I pick up the academic a calendar, and I discover it's got two 14-week semesters.
Hmm.
And so for years, I've been going to the faculty at my institution and saying, listen, we've got this physical plant. It's worth a couple of billion dollars, sunk costs. Why don't we drive it for all 12 months of the year? Let's go from being two 14-week semesters to three 14-week semesters, and then we'll still have plenty of time for vacations. And the professors don't have to teach all three. We can grow the faculty a little, and you pick two out of three to teach and do what you want, research or holidays or whatever you choose with the other. My colleagues rejected that pretty consistently. I failed at making the case for greater efficiency. I think eventually the economics will drive us all to looking at questions like this and say, are we doing the very best to run universities with the finest state-of-the-art management techniques. Now, I hate to use the word management when we talk about universities. We like to think they're in some special category. And to some extent, We need to you need to cut them some slack. We're not manufacturing widgets here, but we need to be transparent, and our budgets need to be more thoughtful than they are.
And what was the objection to that idea?
Well, it would mean uprooting their lives. I mean, you know, these are medieval institutions,
right?
And they've been running with certain traditions mm-hmm. and habits for a long time, and almost uniformly, my faculty were trained under one model, and it's worked for them, and they're happy with it, and I was not sufficiently persuasive to share with them the urgency I felt for getting out ahead of our critics, and say, can we say honestly that we've done everything we can to spend every nickel in the most useful way? Now, I don't mean to squeeze people. I think we ought to be paying our faculty appropriately, and we ought to be providing scholarships, and not just the faculty, by the way. Universities are a community of people from many different trades and artisans. You have librarians, you have plumbers, you have carpenters, you have painters, you have the people who maintain the grounds. And all these people need to be compensated appropriately. At the same time, what they do needs to be clearly not only useful, but efficient.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go next to Jan from Eau Claire. Hi, Jan.
Sure. Some information for the father who has a very bright son. If he would Google Deep Springs College, this is a very unusual school. Our son went there. It's an operating ranch. It's very unusual in many ways. It's an all-male school with only about 12 to 14 students per class.
Oh, my.
It's free. It's tough to get in. You have to write long applications and essays. The students run the ranch, everything from helping in the kitchen, all kinds of hands-on things. They're cowboys. They milk the cows, besides having a very difficult curriculum. And then after these first 2 years that they are at Deep Springs College, the boys can go on to Ivy League schools or any university, and our son chose Cornell University, graduated from the ag school there, and so this was cheaper. Also, Deep Springs produces many Harry Truman scholars, and that scholarship gives the boys money for their education. And our son was chosen 1 year from the state of Wisconsin. So this is an avenue for males. I'm sorry it's not open to females, but again, it's Deep Springs College.
Where is this?
This is on the border of California and Nevada, near Bishop, California.
Yeah, that's a brilliant idea, of course, and there are many others. It's a matter of sitting down and really doing the research. As you were talking, I couldn't help but think of Cooper Union College in New York, which has programs in engineering and art. It is totally free as a result of Mr. Cooper Union's will, and the estate funds. They own the Chrysler Building, among other things, and the money they get from that it's a free tuition, but it's competitive to get in. But once you get in, it's free for all the term until you get the degree, and that's men and women. And somebody might want to be an engineering student in a big city. So you have to look around. There are opportunities. It's a matter of doing the research and finding out what's out there.
You talked earlier about 4,000 universities and colleges. Do you recommend books, or how do you find places that might be somewhat obscure like this?
Well, you go online. I mean, there are books, of course, but that's so 20th and 19th century. you can get an immense amount of information online these days. And hopefully there are professionals in the secondary schools who have been giving full-time thought to these questions and can lend a hand as well.
Mm-hmm.
But in some of the big schools, they're a little overwhelmed, and so I wouldn't rely exclusively on third parties. You have to take responsibility for crafting your own life by researching yourself. But libraries and Google are absolutely the way to do it.
Yeah. More phone calls in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our guest is the author of Big Man on Campus, A University President Speaks Out on Higher Education. Professor Stephen Joel Trachtenberg is with us, professor of public service now and president emeritus of the University of George Washington University. He also served 19 years as the 15th president of that university. He also was president of the University of Hartford and was at Boston University for 8 years as dean of arts and sciences and vice president. Our phone number is in our lines have been jammed. We have a couple lines open right now for you, and the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls. Ed from Wausau, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have two comments. One was as far as the how those tests that test students as far as what their interests and abilities are, they just improved, I mean, quadrupled from the times, you know, when I was in school in the 60s. And my daughter took those, and she's a speech pathologist now. But it's just amazing how they hone in on what your abilities are. And also, there was a caller who was a financial aid counselor, and she was talking about not getting information or whatever from people, tax information. And I ran into that situation with my daughter when I had done my taxes and I sent it in. And then in IRS, I guess they were contractors, I found out later, they had redone my taxes and resent them back to me. And all they gave me was a bunch of, to me, gobbledygook. And for my financial aid information, I copied the gobbledygook and I sent that with my daughter. And when I was called by the financial aid counselor, she said, "We just want a regular income tax return." And I said, "I can't understand what they're doing. And one of my, you know, abilities is abstract reasoning." But anyway, I think a lot of people can be.
Universities are trying very hard to streamline their applications and their financial aid forms. They have some, obviously, federal obligations they have to meet in terms of how they deal with these documents. But they recognize the changing demography. There are going to be a lot of new Americans for whom English is not a first language. And they are endeavoring to make access to the university both practical from the application point of view. They have a common application form, and also to make the financial aid documents as transparent and open as possible.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Ed? It's gone. Thanks very much for your call. We go to Sarah from Pell Lake next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Good morning, everybody.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a interesting situation. I have a learning disability that wasn't caught until I was almost done with college. So I have not very good grades. My test is not very good. I don't do well on them. And I've been out of school too long, so I don't have any references. But I would love to go back and get my master's in museum studies, which is what I've always wanted to do. So how can I go about doing this? I would like to get back on my good books, but I don't think they're that good, so I'm not sure exactly the avenue I need to go.
Well, if you've got the interest, and it certainly sounds like you've got the personality, you're outgoing, I would walk yourself into the university that offers that program and see the administrators and tell them the story. Most admissions people recognize the difference between kids right out of high school or right out of college and adults who've been in the work world for a while. You've got letters of recommendation. They're just not from professors.
Mm-hmm.
But you've been doing something. You know people. They can provide letters. You've got work experience, and that's part of your transcript as well. You can talk about what you've been doing with yourself and your accomplishments. So don't be discouraged and look around and if should you be interested, by the way, my own university, George Washington University, has a terrific museum studies master's
really?
Degree,
huh.
And I'd be happy to see you here.
All right, Sarah. You made the right call on the right day. Listening
awesome.
To the right show.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. It is true that if you got some creativity about you and a personality, you can walk into a lot of doors, can't you?
People are basically welcoming. I mean, it's
right.
true that they retreat into being bureaucrats from time to time, and you can't count on every single one of them. But in general, I find university people are pleased with what they're doing, and they're delighted that people want more education and they want to share. Now you can clearly run into somebody who's got a ministerial clerical personality, and they don't, you know, they don't want to risk anything.
Mm-hmm.
But if you run into them, say, I want to see your boss.
Mm-hmm. You announced that you would step down from the presidency of George Washington. You took an hour, you had a cup of coffee in front of the library, looking at everybody passing you by, decided you would write a book about this. And you also say that you had worries for the future of American higher education and the challenge of instituting innovation and efficiency. What are your worries about American higher education?
Well, we're losing ground, I think, to global competition. We're still the best system in the world, but we need to keep investing in it. And I'm concerned that our nation is challenged for resource allocation. We've got to do more for the elderly. We've got 50 million people who have no health insurance. We've got a large number of new Americans, and they need help. Our infrastructure has got problems. My son married a girl from Minnesota, and while I was out there, a bridge fell down. And so we got roads and bridges and tunnels and dams. There's just an immense number of things we've got to invest America's wealth in, elementary and secondary schools. And whether Obama gets elected president or McCain gets elected president, these problems are not going to go away. And we've got the inherited debt that we're going to be bringing forward from our struggles in Afghanistan and in Iraq. And so higher education is going to be scrapping for every public dollar more than they ever have in the past. And there is a certain amount of skepticism about higher education now in the American public. And we've got to overcome that. And we have to pretend that we have no past that we can rely on, and we have to introduce ourselves to the people. And we have to make the case for higher education. And I don't think that's always easy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clear we have much to give. And if we are going to prevail in the 21st century as a country, we need to have the best educated citizenry we can possibly create.
Lynn from Denver. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a note to that gentleman who's concerned about his son that's so bright.
Mm-hmm.
I am from Iowa, and I used to speak to a really good small college there, and I'm sure there are some like this around the country. I had two children that came back to Iowa, and I was so excited, and they graduated from Grinnell. And it's just a little college, but they prepare kids for grad school. They, you know, you can be a chemistry major, but you take art, and you minor in history or philosophy. It's one of those places that you just can do it all. It's called Grinnell.
Mm-hmm, true.
And they are need blind. I mean, we couldn't really get much aid because of our salaries, but you can go there really cheap. And one thing this I did with one of my kids, and it was an idea from a neighbor, and if his son's really creative, I made it like a job when my daughter got to be a junior, and I said, hey, you want money for college? Every scholarship you apply for, I'll pay you $20, but they got to be good quality. And she really drummed up a couple good ones. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's a chance for a kid that's bright and creative to kind of, you know, go out there, do some research, you know, and find out what Walmart or the local pizza place and bigger name things are doing. And you can at least for that first year, you can get a lot of cash if you are bright, like they said. And I also want to say, you know, he talks about jobs. I had to go into education, just what my parents had me do. And I hated it. I hated it. I hated teaching for about the first 5 years. But now I absolutely love it. I hate the thought of retiring. I have just grown to absolutely love a job. And I have so many things I can do there. And so sometimes, you know, things work out. You know, you kind of work your way into something. So I would say, you know, I really appreciate your speaker. And I would tell that man, you know, good luck to his son because there's tons he can get, and he doesn't have to worry about the money. He'll be fine.
Okay, thanks, Lynn.
Yep, we need to worry about that young man, and we need to attend to those who have historically been left behind as a whole.
Right.
I mean, the demography is changing. We're going to see more Hispanics, more African Americans, more Asians as part of the American mosaic, and we need to integrate all of those people into our talent pool. We
mm-hmm.
need to develop an ability to bring kids whose parents never went to college into our schools and train them to be the physicians and the lawyers, the scientists, the teachers for the next generation. The baby boomers are starting to depart. They perhaps will go on to legacy careers, maybe in public service for a while, but it's time to bring up a whole new generation of young people, and our universities have a very significant role to play in that.
Yeah, thank you so much. Great hour. Such enthusiasm from you. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you, Kathleen. I'm honored to have been here. My wife worked for many years for WETA, public television here in Washington, and so
great.
I have a great sympathy for the whole system.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. The author of Big Man on Campus, University President, speaks out on higher education. Stephen Joel Trachtenberg, our guest, and the book has been published by Touchstone Books. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Treader for on-air production here in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your calls. Until tomorrow at 9, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.